All right, thanks everyone. Have a seat, please. Good morning. We're here today on the Hamlin versus Gessler case. It's set for 1 hour. Each side will have 30 minutes. We'll ask you to keep track of your own time, please. May I have the entry of appearances?
Good morning, Your Honors. Leanne Morrill versus Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the petitioner, Colorado Secretary of State Scott Gessler. With me at counsel's table is co-counsel Matthew Grove, Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Edward Ramey and Martha Tierney on behalf of the plaintiffs at police.
All right, thanks. I'm the argument. You'll be arguing, sir?
Yes.
Thank you very much. Are we ready to go? Counsel, please.
May it please the court. The facts of this case are few and, at least in the trial court, did not appear to be materially disputed by the parties. So unless the court has any questions for me at this time about the facts, I'm going to delve right into the jurisdictional argument that Secretary Gessler raised both in the trial court and again here on appeal. And that is whether or not a plaintiff may bring a Section 1-1-113 action for an event occurring on or after the date of an election. And in this case, we have an Election Day Emergency Rule, Rule 10.7.5, promulgated by the Secretary of State at approximately 5:19 p.m. on Election Day, on November 5th. So before the polls closed, before the election judges conducted their initial count, before Canvas, before the results were certified, the Secretary took action through his rulemaking powers to fill a gap that he perceived to exist in the statute, a gap that had been brought to his attention late in the game or the days leading up to the election. So, what we had here is a plaintiff who came in under 1-1-113 after the date of the election. And our concern with this type of proceeding occurring after the date of an election is that under the code, it makes very clear that 1-1-113 proceedings are summary in nature. And the way we have approached them consistently is the plaintiffs file a verified petition. The secretary and the other election officials whose actions may be challenged do not answer that verified petition. Instead, we notify the court, get the first trial date possible, and we show up and we put up our evidence, exhibits, testimony, cross-examination, oral argument. We do endeavor in all instances to submit a trial brief to the court prior to the date of the hearing. But from a policy standpoint, I think if the provision is read within the context of the code as a whole, it becomes clear that it was intended for courts to be able to adjudicate, meaning from start to finish, review, consider, and decide controversies based on alleged wrongful acts or omissions occurring prior to the date of an election.
I mean after the election, just to sort that.
Well, this particular action was brought after the date of the
election. I'm talking about the election contest.
And then there's a separate proceeding under Article 11 of the Election Code for election contests. But this case was postured in the district court under 1-1-113. And the Secretary's intention, Justice Hobbs, is that is not an appropriate procedural method for the plaintiffs to bring their cause of action to a court's attention. Now, in no way is the Secretary suggesting that the court lacks jurisdiction to consider disputes occurring after the date.
I think the problem here is the disconnect between the Administrative Procedure Act procedure and the Election Code procedure in sorting out what the judicial role is versus the Secretary of State's role. Would you agree? At least a part of it.
I agree, absolutely, at least a part of it. As you know, the APA itself contains a provision for courts to conduct their administrative review of an agency's rulemaking on an expedited basis. And the secretary doesn't contend that that portion of the plaintiff's action was improper. Where our contention is that the 1-1-1-13 proceeding alleging breach or neglect by an election official, and that breach or neglect did not occur prior to the day of the election, it occurred on the day of the election, and it was going to affect counting activities conducted by the election judges after the date of the election. Our contention is simply that 1-1-1-13 should have a cutoff. And we suggest to this court that you give us some clarity on whether, one, we're correct, and two, if our suggested cutoff date is acceptable to the court. And the reason for this is simply because in 2013, it was the year of the recall. So for the Secretary of State and other election officials, it was the year of the 1-1-1-13 proceeding. The Secretary participated in no fewer than 5 summary proceedings under the Election Code, some of which had Parts 1 and Parts 2 and Parts 3. And as you know, because in certain cases we did petition this court for review, not all of those decisions, or, you know, I think it was in only one instance did we actually get review by the court of any of those 113 proceedings. So these proceedings can arise in jurisdictions throughout the state, and we get sort of a vast difference in both the way the plaintiffs posture their cases and the way in which the district courts conduct them. And it affects everything from the standard of review, who may bring the action, the burden of proof, the remedies that are afforded by the court or contemplated by the court. It affects such things as whether or not a successful party can obtain attorney's fees and costs. I mean, there. If you look at the Election Code as a whole, there are a variety of mechanisms by which interested parties can bring problems with the election process to the court's attention.
Counsel, maybe it would be helpful if you could tell us what they should have done.
Sure. I think what they should have done is one of two things. The preferable course of action would have been to wait until the election results have been certified, at which point the county clerks of Adams and Broomfield counties were operating under the secretary's rule 10.7.5. They would have not counted the votes for any votes cast for Ms. Spears. And then if the contention was that was the incorrect procedure, then they could challenge it under Article 11 of the Election Code, which provides for contests.
And what you're saying then, the votes should be counted. I mean, it's certainly out there.
The rule absolutely says that if a candidate's disqualification is discovered prior to the day of an election, but not in time to remove his or her name from the ballot, that votes cast for that candidate are invalid and should not be counted. And the secretary believes that rule is entirely consistent with 3 other provisions of the Election Code that expressly contemplate invalidating votes and not counting them. And those are for votes cast for write-in candidates who have not filed the appropriate write-in affidavit of intent, votes cast for withdrawn candidates, and votes cast for deceased candidates.
Well, then the contest would be over whether or not she actually resided in the district or not.
Correct, Your Honor. It would not only be limited to that, it would also be the contesters would be able to bring a claim specifically that the election officials tasked with administering the election failed to count valid votes, mm-hmm. and improperly deemed certain votes invalid. So the secretary's contention is really simple, that just about anything that happens after the polls close on election day, with very limited exceptions, can properly be challenged through an election contest, which is subject to its own set of procedures. It allows for depositions, it instructs trial courts to set the trial within a certain period of time, it has different appellate procedures, and they're not all, in every instance, worlds apart. But if we're keeping with the court's prior decisions that the more specific provisions of statutes should control over more general ones, I think when you're looking at disputes where somebody is interested in changing the outcome of the election, that's where a contest is appropriate.
I mean, your answer to my question was, well, they should have waited, but I don't understand how you control plaintiff behavior by telling them they should wait. I want you to expound on that a bit. I mean, you would say we should write an opinion that says they cannot file such a claim until later?
May I piggyback on Justice Ed's question? What you're saying makes a lot of sense, but what troubles me about this particular situation is that the emergency rule changed the status quo. Had that emergency rule not been passed, it, by all indications, these county clerks would have in fact counted those votes, and then that changes the posture here because it would have put the losing contestant in the position of having to bring the election contest. And so my understanding is that the focus of the challenge here is actually the promulgation of the emergency rule, which was an election day dispute, and also then tied up with the election day counting process. And so I guess, like Justice Iden, why should a plaintiff be barred from attacking that piece of it as it's unfolding on election day?
Sure, and certainly we're not suggesting not that the plaintiff should be barred from bringing any challenge. It's the particular type of challenge. And it's, the Secretary's contention is only against the procedure, because 11113 is a self-contained procedure which contemplates a dispute or controversy arising prior to the day of an election where the election is getting off course. And that it's essentially the equivalent of a show cause proceeding. And the court issues a show cause order to the election officials to show up, gives them an opportunity to be heard, and then says, go forth, substantially comply with the code, and or to explain to me why you cannot or should not be made to.
But why should that not apply? I mean, if I'm understanding your argument correctly, the deadline ends at midnight at the commencement of the election day. So when chaos ensues on election day, what is the problem? You allow chaos to just unfold and then go in afterwards and file an election contest?
No, so that's one alternative. Allow the chaos to unfold, or alternatively, file under Rule 65. Meet the burdens, the substantial burdens, on any litigant to temporarily enjoin the conduct of an election, to bind election officials who specifically have been trained and tasked and have superior knowledge and expertise in how to administer their elections.
And recognizing that Rule 65 comes with its own set of standards, mm-hmm, and different burdens and things like that differ from the 11113, how does that actually help out the Secretary? I mean, as I understand your position, you've been bombarded with these 11113 actions, and it's causing a lot of problems because they unfold so quickly. But how does shifting that into a Rule 65 action change that?
I think it puts considerably more burden on the plaintiffs, and I think as it should. I think that once the polls close at 7 p.m. on election day, the process of counting, the process of canvassing, the process of recounting, if any, anything that happens within that process, barring very few exceptions, for example, if, say, election watchers were excluded from being able to watch, which they could then bring some type of injunctive action under Rule 65 to get immediate relief to change that. But anything that happens after 7 p.m. on election day is undoable, it's reversible. There's no need for a summary proceeding under the election code because that contemplates resetting the election. But once we're past the election, the Secretary's contention is that plaintiffs have an appropriate avenue under Rule 65 or through an election contest to challenge anything that goes on in the days after an election. And all we can do is offer our, you know, humble experiences trying these 11113 proceedings. And we're not suggesting that they should in any way be limited for breaches or wrongful acts that occur prior to the date of the election. We're more than happy to you know, stay up all night. I mean, for example, we got a 11113 proceeding on November 2nd. We came in on Sunday, November 3rd. We worked through the night to put together a trial brief. I personally went home, changed, came back at 9 a.m. I was in trial from 2 p.m. until 10 p.m. on the day before the election, we had harnessed representatives from the Secretary of State's office, from the county clerk's offices of Douglas, Broomfield, various other counties, and we were there to explain to the judge why the code was being followed and why the plaintiffs could not show their cause for the relief requested under 111.13. And we ultimately prevailed, and we're happy to do that. As I explained to the court, it was Judge Martinez in Denver District. The secretary will show up anytime, any place, to right the course of an election that's getting off track. But here, we're past it. The rule took effect at 5:19, but it was going to be applied post-closing of the polls. And any relief that the plaintiffs could have requested under 111.13 could have been afforded to them under Rule 65 or through an election contest.
I was just going to ask, I thought at one point earlier you said something about other vehicles to challenge the validity of the rule. So did you believe that could have been done without styling this as a 111.13? And what effect would that have then on the order itself and whether there was counting?
Yes, Justice Coates, the Secretary does not contend that the APA claim was inappropriate. And does not contend that the trial court does not have the inherent authority and the express authority under the APA to expedite its administrative review of rulemaking. But again, there's expedited and then there's really, really expedited, right? And so the goal of 111.13 is to really expedite the proceedings so that the election officials tasked with administering the election get the instruction they need to do things that can't be reversed after the election, such as put somebody on the ballot who the secretary deemed his or her petition insufficient. So,
but what's at issue here is whether these votes should be counted or not, wasn't it? And I guess what I'm curious about is if you push this process back, how would that affect the decision to count or not to count if, as I think you're saying, even though it could be expedited, you feel like a proceeding under the APA to challenge the validity of the rule would have taken longer. But if it came to this outcome, would it be better to, would that require an undoing or presumption that the rules, that the votes had never been counted or had been counted? How would that affect the ultimate question?
Procedurally, it would depend on how the court decided to handle the APA claim and whether it would decide to expedite it to such an extent as it would under a 111.13 proceeding. But of course, we would argue that there was less need to conduct it on an expedited basis. I hope that answers your question. I do want to talk about the substance of the rule, and my time as always
just one question on that, though. I mean, do you want us to address the jurisdiction question and determine that this was improperly considered under 111.13 and I mean, you're moving on to the merits, but do you actually want us to address the merits?
If you don't agree with our argument that 111.13 should cut off on okay. the date of the election, yes. I mean, it is an alternative argument, but we have a vested stake in this, Justice Ide, and we are repeat players in the system, and we would like some guidance from this court on what it views as the appropriate scope of a 111.13 proceeding. And I understand maybe you don't need to get there to consider this case, and that's kind of, you know, if we have the opportunity, we want to make the argument.
Thank you.
So, going to the substance of the rule, the plaintiff's contention is really simple, that the specific provisions of the school district election statute, specifically 2231.129, govern the exact scenario that you're dealing with here. And the secretary feels that that is completely incorrect. If you look at the plain language of that provision, the vacancy committee provision, or the vacancy provision of the school director statute, you will see that it contemplates vacancies arising prior to the expiration of a term of office and vacancies that would somehow disqualify an officer, not a candidate, an officer. And some intervening, so between the date that an individual takes office and the date their term of office expires, some intervening occurrence happens and that triggers a vacancy. We don't have that here. Here we have the Secretary of State. Well, first of all, backing up, first we have the designated election official for the school district finding out that Ms. Spears was not, in fact, qualified at the time she became a candidate for school director of District 4, approximately 1 week before the election. She notified Ms. Spears and requested that she submit a withdrawal. Perhaps the only unknown fact, and there's no dispute that, you know, Ms. Spears did not withdraw, is why? Why did she not withdraw? She knows she can't take office. She knows she can't swear the oath. She knows the oath that she swore and affirmed that she met the qualifications of office when she petitioned on the ballot was incorrect. It was false. And we're not saying it was knowingly false. We're not saying it was intentionally false. But we're saying she had knowledge prior to the date of the election that she was not qualified to undertake that office. And she didn't do anything about it. So the question here is simply whether or not election officials, and in particular the Secretary of State, who is vested with broad rulemaking power under the election code, can take action to preserve the democratic process, to preserve the qualifications for office that the General Assembly has put into place, to preserve and prevent the use of sham candidates. These were all the motivations behind the Secretary's rule, and we believe that it was a reasonable interpretation of the statute, consistent with the other provisions of the election code that allow certain votes cast to be deemed invalid and not counted. If I have no questions, I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You certainly may. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, please, the court. I think I'll first go to the 11113 argument, though the court is aware, I think, from our briefs that we've suggested to you that the argument is both moot in that the activities at which the 11113 claim was directed in this action have already been fully performed. And secondly, that Secretary of State doesn't have standing to raise that argument because the 11113 arguments were not directed at the Secretary of State. Now, what this case is primarily about is the rule. I think Justice Hobbs alluded to it at the beginning of counsel's argument, that we challenge the rule, the emergency rule, under 24.4.106.4 of the EPA. When we brought the action, we did not know, we put the hand in the court, what the positions of the other election officials, the clerks and recorders, and the designated election official would be. We know that they were not counting the votes. We knew that it had to do with this rule, at least in part, but we didn't know if we needed a 1113 directive to them, even if the district court were to invalidate the rule. It was clearly blocking them from our perception. So we brought a 11113 claim as well. That was directed at the other election officials, not at the Secretary of State. Now, having said that, I think we also noted in the briefs that this court has stated that notwithstanding, even if you agree with us with regard to the standing mootness issues, this court has stated there are certain issues that arise to a significant enough level of importance to court can address them. I'm not viewing that as an advisory opinion. And I have to say on behalf of the plaintiffs' appellees in this case that we do not object to the court doing that. This issue arises regularly. I think counsel has mentioned that, and guidance from this court might be helpful. But
Where does that get us, though? Because you want the school board to be able to fill the vacancy,
right?
Versus the voters having before them actually viable candidates based on the law.
That's correct, Justice Hobbs. Even if this court were to agree, I don't think that would be the proper conclusion, of course. But if the court were to agree with counsel's interpretation of 11113, that should not affect the jurisdictional basis, and it was pled as the jurisdictional basis for our challenge to the rule. And our challenge to the rule was under the APA. So I don't hear this court saying or counsel suggesting that we can't bring an APA action. We brought an APA action, as it turns out, and we didn't know this until the actual record was developed in court. As it turns out, we didn't need any further relief directed against the clerks and recorders to get the votes released. They had done that. It's the APA action which really controlled. We asked for a forfeit hearing based primarily on that. We got a forfeit hearing based on that. Now, the appeal to this court was styled as a 1113 appeal. I suppose we've done that. I've never asked this court for a forfeit hearing. Okay? I don't know how that would be received up here, probably not well. At any rate, we didn't object to an expedited process for a whole lot of fairly obvious reasons with regard to this court's consideration. But this appeal really, I think, is in the context of what you've done is given us a forfeit hearing on an APA claim. And we thank you for that. The Secretary thanks you as well. But it's not a 113 claim that's directed to them. Now, I'll shift, unless the court has any questions about that, I'll shift to the merits of the ruling, because that's what this is really about. I guess I should also say, this is not an election contest either. This is about the rule. There is an election contest, as Your Honor's aware, pending, and that has to do with whether Ms. Spears is or is not qualified for office. We're presuming here today that she is not, but that has never been adjudicated as yet. That is a claim that is proceeding in the pending election contest. The second claim in that action is, if she is in fact not qualified to assume office, does the candidate that ran against her, Mr. Figueroa, basically win by default, even though he received a substantially lower vote count than
Ms. Could I follow up on that? I thought it was everyone was agreed that she was not qualified. You're saying that's not the case?
No, the presumption in this case.
That's only the presumption in this case?
That's correct, okay. Chief Justice. That's the presumption in this case. I have every reason to believe that that is correct. But the designated election official from the school board has made that determination, as counsel noted. No court has so ruled as yet.
Okay.
And frankly, we never would have gotten to that had the rule not been vacated, the emergency rule, by the district court, because we never would have known the vote count. The original vote count that was released in the wake of the election was 100% of the votes were cast for Mr. Figueroa, the other candidate. We never would have known. And by the way, when the vote count was really, the actual votes were ultimately released. Had Mr. Figueroa received the higher number of votes, I mean, that would have perhaps mooted this action. I don't know, and certainly would have mooted any election contest. But as Your Honors are aware, that they don't happen, it's quite the reverse. With regard to the rule, and I'll shift into that, because this is the focus of our challenge. That emergency rule. It was presented and is worded, and I think counsel will agree, as a rule of general application, not only to this case and to Ms. Spears and Mr. Figueroa and to school board elections in particular, but to elections in general. It creates a circumstance whereupon a designated election official determines that, a designated election official, not a court, determines that a candidate is not qualified for office, and it is too late to take the candidate's name off the ballot, that the votes for that candidate shall be deemed invalid and shall not be counted. There are only two provisions that I have been able to find in the Colorado Election Code, which generally governs school board elections, and also a few provisions in the code regarding the school boards that supplement that authorize or state that votes by voters shall be deemed invalid and shall not be counted. Now, there are a number of circumstances where, for example, if I vote
My vote would be invalidated and not counted for a whole variety of different reasons, including something's wrong with my ballot, I'm not a qualified elector, I voted for a write-in candidate, that would be unqualified, whatever the case may be. But when a candidate's name appears on a ballot, so it's too late to stop that. The ballot is out the door. In this particular case, not only were the ballots out the door, this was a mail ballot election, voting was going on by the time the issue regarding the spirit had surfaced. People had voted and returned ballots. We were 7 days before election day and in the midst of the voting process. But there are only two situations per Colorado General Assembly in which if it's too late to get a name off a ballot, that the voters' votes will be deemed invalid or not counted. One is in the event that the designated election official and person reporters discover that the candidate has died. And the other is if the candidate has withdrawn, and withdrawal by statute requires an affirmative act of the candidate, submission of a written, signed, acknowledged statement of withdrawal.
Could I interrupt you before you leave this point?
Oh, sorry. Just any time, sir.
I noticed in your briefs, too, you clearly made the distinction of those cases where there is a ballot printed up with the name on the ballot versus not one. But I was having trouble seeing why we should separate out the situation in which there is a write-in candidate whose votes would not be counted, if I understand that right, if he's unqualified. That seems to be, although his name is not on the ballot, nevertheless, it is a vote for him, which is not going to be counted. And the question is, unlike withdrawal or death, which couldn't really be disputed, it is one that involves his qualifications, which presumably could be challenged. In which case, I presume the votes could then be counted.
Right.
Would that not be the same situation with this kind of a rule?
I guess, Justice Scalia, if I were arguing in the General Assembly, which I try not to do, I might make that argument. I'll try to call into the mind of the General Assembly if I can with regard to that. I'm guessing, based at least in part on the context of how the entire statutory structure is put together, which includes the vacancy statutes and so forth, and the common law background, which we alluded to perhaps excessively, and a prior opinion of this court, though I don't think any of you were here when that opinion came down, the Keating opinion, which is the backdrop from which the current laws have arisen, that I'm guessing and thinking that the concept is that a write-in vote is different from a presentation of the ballot to the voters. That once a ballot has been presented to the voters and it's in their hands and a name is on it, it belongs to them at that point. Their votes are valid if they vote for somebody whose name appears on that ballot. Their votes are valid and they aren't in the count. It doesn't mean the person gets to assume office for all the reasons that we've been discussing regarding this qualification, but their votes are valid and the legislature used a write-in vote as a little bit different because that name is not on the ballot that's presented to the people. Now, that's pure speculation by me. I'm trying to call into the head of the legislature. But the one thing that's clear, I think, in the statute, and that's Smithville's court, in the statutory structure, not just the language of the particular sections, but statutory structure, is there are only those two exceptions. Withdrawal, formal withdrawal, and death, which will invalidate and result in a no count for votes cast for a candidate whose name appears on the ballot. And there are even exclusions from that, particularly in the partisan context. Even that invalidation and no count authorization is overridden by vacancy appointment processes in the partisan context. We're dealing here with the school board situation, and as counsel indicated, there's a vacancy statute which is different. It's 2231-129, which I would submit comes into play if we have a situation like this where there is not an authorization of the votes not be counted and be invalidated. There's some.
So you disagree with this argument that was made here? You think that that advances in line over the actual validity of a candidate's position to run for the office? We have lots of elections in these special districts and so on where you only have maybe one viable candidate. So right. I'm a little concerned about your, he won by default.
Well, and I'm not sure I understand your question.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, it's circling around to the fact that one of the most important duties of the Secretary of State is to make sure the election is, let me use these words, shaped up in compliance with the law. Okay? And it seems to me your viewpoint is that the school board substitute itself now for who ought to be in that office.
That clarifies the question.
Okay.
Thank you for that. And I don't mean to be stating that. Let me kind of work on both ends of your question, but starting in the middle being that the issue here today is solely the issue of when can names that appear on the ballot, and there's been a process to get there, where mistakes obviously can be made, and one presumptively was made here, but there's a process to get there, but where a name appears on the ballot, goes into the hands of the voters. The General Assembly has said there are very limited circumstances in which you invalidate and don't count the votes. Otherwise, they're counted, and then we do something else if an ineligible candidate wins. Now, on the front end of your question, Justice Hobbs, there are a whole lot of things. There's a long string of processes that take place prior to the election that are designed to prevent ineligible, disqualified, otherwise improper candidates from appearing on the ballot. Secretary of State is deeply involved in that process. Other election officials, designated election officials, are clerks and recorders to some extent are. It starts with the entire access to the ballot processes. It starts with the, in the school board case, with the submission of a petition, with a statement of an intent to run for office, and petitions that are reviewed by the designated election official. There's a protest period that follows that, so if there's a statement of sufficiency that comes out of the designated election official, that can be challenged. There is, after that, there is a long opportunity under Section 15412 that permits correction of errors on a ballot if it's not too late to correct those errors. There are opportunities for, if a designated election official or a clerk or recorder does not correct the errors, the state does not get involved and they should get involved. There's an opportunity, I would agree with counsel on this, for a 11113 action at that point. There are lots of steps along the way to access. Now, what we're talking about here, and the analogy made to take this to an extreme in the district court, was what if I decide to put my dog on the ballot, or something of that nature. There was discussion in the district court about how do we keep dogs on the ballot. Well, that would have to go all the way through that process. And everybody would have missed it, not only designated election officials, but virtually all of the election officials of all opposing candidates as well would be missing the substance of disqualification. Any qualified elector could bring a 11113 action. There's quite a road to get to the ballot. But in the rare circumstance, we have one here, where we've gotten all the way through that, and for whatever reason, it's too late to take that name off the ballot. The General Assembly has made it pretty clear that, with very limited exceptions, death and withdrawal, and even limited in those cases, that the votes are counted, and then if a candidate who is not qualified gets the plurality of the votes and wins the election, there is another process that now steps in, and it will hopefully not happen with any great frequency, and that's the vacancy process. There's a vacancy process for partisan elections, which is very detailed and time elements to it. What happens at different times? There is a specific vacancy appointment process in the context of school board elections in particular.
Mr. Ramey, doesn't this put the unqualified candidate in the position of being able to dictate the outcome of the election?
No, I don't think so, Justice Hood. I'm not sure I understand, again, your question.
Well, it seems very counterintuitive to me that you have someone who shouldn't be on the ballot in the first place who can throw this into the vacancy process simply by refusing to withdraw. Why? Maybe the question is, am I wrong in thinking that that's counterintuitive when the person can't be duly, well, is it counterintuitive?
Well, if a person is not qualified, I don't think it's counterintuitive. But I think I understand your point. If a person is not qualified for office due to non-residency or any reason for disqualification, which could be in school board context, being a sex offender, having been convicted of a felony, any number of other circumstances, that person can be removed all the way up to the point where the ballot goes out with that person's name on it. At that point, I guess I want to go back to my characterization a little while ago. At that moment, the ballot belongs to the voters. And that candidate, that unqualified candidate, Ms. Spears in this particular case, isn't manipulating or controlling anything. The ballot went out with her name, the voters voted, and the votes, overwhelming votes for her, can be viewed, giving a little deference to the voters, which is what this is really all about, as much a vote against the opposing candidate as an endorsement of her. And the voters' wishes are then, Colorado has determined that if an election then fails, which is, I think, using the old common law standard, if an unqualified candidate obtains the plurality of the votes, the election fails, so what then? What our General Assembly has done is say, well, then we're going to entrust the vacancy appointment process to somebody that it makes sense to entrust it to. In a partisan context, it's always entrusted to the partisan body that supported the candidate that got the unqualified candidate who got the plurality of the votes. In this context, which is nonpartisan, it's vested in the elected school itself.
Council, may I interrupt you here?
Absolutely.
If I understand the gist of your argument, your concern is that the Secretary of State's rule went too far by crafting a rule that basically invalidates votes. And in general, the legislature has identified really specific circumstances under which we're going to actually invalidate votes, and the rule went too far by doing that here. I understand that. Is that a fair summary of your position?
That's correct. I'd say more than just going too far. I mean, it's the statutory structure says we invalidate votes in limited circumstances here, otherwise we do other things.
Okay.
And what this rule does is say, no.
And I'd like to move to the other things.
Okay.
So let's move to there. Your reading of the 22-31-129 suggests that, in essence, Ms. Spears was duly elected here and this vacancy process should be followed. Could you respond to the Secretary's argument that subsection 1 talks about school director office shall be deemed vacant upon the occurrence of any murder following events prior to the expiration of the term of office? I mean, how does one enter a term of office in order to trigger these events and trigger your reading of the statute?
Well, if we look just at this statutory provision, Justice Marquez, even outside of the structure, I would suggest that the Secretary is reading this to say that a school director office shall be deemed vacant upon the occurrence of these events after the commencement of and prior to the expiration of. They're inserting a phrase in there. All it says is prior to the expiration of the term of office. Now, there are events listed in 22-31-129 which cannot occur after the commencement of the term of office, particularly subsection subparagraph B, 1B, which talks about taking the oath of office. The term of office is not going to commence until somebody takes an oath. So the other is, the second one would be D. The person is or becomes a non-resident. If we assume that the term of office has commenced, is or becomes, to give is any meaning, the person has to be a non-resident upon commencement.
And I understand the argument about is and how you're distinguishing is from becomes. How do we read duly elected? The secretary puts a lot of emphasis on tying that backwards to duly nominated and then tying the duly nominated back to eligibility for office in the first place. What is your reading of duly elected? Is it simply the person who garnered the most votes? And how do you suggest?
Duly elected, we had this discussion at some length below in the district court, as to whether there's a substantive component or just a procedural component to the word duly. And I would submit to the court that duly elected, in the context of not only this section, but of the entire statutory structure, has to be read as mainly the processes for election have been followed, not that duly means the person was qualified to be a candidate. And if I could give a parallel example, not to pound the old common law dicta from the Keating case, but it's illustrative. The candidate at issue there, and this is the ground upon which these statutes grew out of, so it's not totally irrelevant, but the candidate there was alleged to have been clearly unqualified to be a candidate because he was an election official and there was a charter that provision that prohibited him from running for other office. So we clearly faced there a situation of an unqualified candidate. Yet, in dicta, because they ultimately found him unqualified, but in dicta the court explained that nevertheless the election, you count the votes and the election fails if that person gets the most votes. And that's the old American versus English rule approach. I think the proper reading of duly is simply procedural. The person's name was on the ballot, rightly or wrongly, qualified or not, subject to invalidation through an election contest, through a court ruling under subsection F of 2231-129, subject to all kinds of things. Voters went to the polls, they voted, this person got the most votes, that person has been duly elected. Now, they may not be qualified. Their ability to take office may be negated by a court. The election may be set aside by the court. They may be a non-resident. They may not take the oath of office. All kinds of things may happen, but they're still procedurally duly elected. I think that's how you have to read it.
If you lose the battle on duly elected, is there any way you can win the war?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I've thought it all the way through at all ends. I think we still do. Because there is still no, we get ourselves into a quandary, Justice, that I think if we do what you just suggested, in that there is no authorization not to count the votes. In a situation like this, we don't have a deceased or withdrawn candidate. So if you read the word duly to take away the vacancy process, I don't know what we have then, other than having to call a special election or having, which I think was done in the old days, the person who was in office continue to serve until the next election.
Could I?
That's not good.
would that, though, then create the gap you say doesn't exist for the Attorney General, for the Secretary of State to make a rule?
I don't think it's a gap. I mean, I think the legislature has been very specific. First of all, when you have a no count, an invalidation of no count, there's no gap in it. I think the statutory structure can be clearly read and logically read to have no gap exist. If we take Justice Hood's hypothetical meaning of the word duly, I hope it's hypothetical, of the word duly, I think what we engineer is a vacancy process out of play. I'm not sure that creates a gap.
At least this provision, then, would not bring into play the vacancy process, right? If as Justice Hood proposes, we construe duly elected in the manner suggested by the Secretary of State, then at least this provision would not require the vacancy process to take effect. Wouldn't that be true?
And you're talking about this particular statute?
Right, Justice, the 129.
I think actually parts of it would still come into play. I think under F, for example, a court could void an officer's election for any cause whatsoever. And duly elected is in the context of the second phrase there, removing a person duly elected. I think under 1F of 2231-129, that a court of competent jurisdiction can void an election, period, for whatever reason, and then the vacancy process of 2231-129 is invoked. So I think you still get there, even if you read duly the way Justice Hood suggests. I'm suggesting that's a strange way to read that in the context of this provision, a structure which is designed to address all the eventualities and not losing sight of the common law background.
Ultimately, though, this case, from at least the way I'm seeing it right now, is that this has to do with the Secretary of State's authority.
Yes.
Kind of like the no gap deal, but I come out maybe tentatively saying that Secretary of State was acting within the Secretary of State's authority. Oh, and that, you know, the qualification for office is a very important, maybe the essential piece of this.
I don't think if the legislature has made its choices about how to deal, Justice Hobbs, with the question you just posed.
Yeah, but they know there's this authority in the Secretary of State that's right inherently in the statutes and then rulemaking authority.
But they have not left a gap, taking the Chevron approach to it. They have not left a gap for the Secretary of the Field to fill on this particular issue of invalidation and no count there. We would submit to you that there is no gap there to be filled. And to take the Chevron approach, which I think this court has on numerous occasions accepted, is that if the legislative intent is clear, that is the end of the matter. There is no room for administrative action. And really, with all due respect, we should not be re-deciding that here in this court.
One more question, thanks.
Could I just follow up on that?
Absolutely.
Because you haven't had an opportunity to address, I think, the primary argument that they're making. In this way, you say that the legislature has determined that there are two areas where you would not count the votes. Maybe right hand is a third area, but let's just assume there's two, one of which is withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Here, they went to the candidate and said, you need to withdraw. You say, well, presuming she's not eligible, but I think she's not eligible. She didn't say, I am eligible. Yeah. So why wouldn't we want to not count those votes from a policy perspective? It's the same situation. It's just simply here she refuses to withdraw.
For a couple reasons, Justice, number one, the candidate is not a party here. What's motivating her is really not an issue. It's how the statutory process works. I would submit that initially.
But the statutory process presumes someone would withdraw.
I frankly would disagree with that, Justice. I'm not sure that it does. As a matter of fact, the withdrawal process has been made, I would say, cumbersome. But it's almost like we're talking about a compelled speech issue here in a way. But to withdraw this candidate for whatever reason would have to actually submit and not only sign but acknowledge withdrawal.
But how about the quality of the votes? You're saying there's something, a sanctity about votes being
yes.
cast for somebody. How is that different here? I'm really trying to pinpoint you on that.
Well, I hope I'm understanding the question. I think the point, once again, I'm not being repetitive, but once a name appears on a ballot, the process belongs to the voters. It's the voters' intent that matter. frankly, it doesn't matter at this stage. I'm going to perhaps overstate my case again here, but if the name on the ballot is a dog, it is the voters' statements that count. If you look at the old cases, there's a lot of talk about democracy and this is how it should work, the majority rule, and so forth. What Ms. Spears' intent is at this point, frankly, has nothing to do with anything. And I can make, I think, a very compelling argument. And I haven't spoken with him, so I have no idea what's going on in her mind. But I can make a very compelling argument that her refusal to withdraw, if we want to call it that, is an act of some courage at this particular stage. Because what she's saying is, in the face of a 63% vote count for me, I am not going to withdraw and let an election default. I'm going to, in support of my supporters, let this go into the vacancy process, which is where Democratic voters belong.
Thank you.
I'd like to address Justice Hood's question squarely. If the plaintiffs lose the battle on duly elected, they lose the war. Let me tell you why. The district court accepted the contention that duly elected simply meant there was an election, that there was an actual procedure by which an election occurred, ballots were issued, votes were cast, votes were counted, there's your process, that's what duly means. Here's why that's wrong. Colorado prohibits marriage between an individual who is already married and an individual who has not been married, and prohibits marriage by close blood relatives. Now, the equivalent of plaintiff's argument is if, well, I really want to marry my sister, and I've got a certificate, and I get somebody to perform the ceremony who's authorized to do so, and here we are, we're married, you can't void that marriage. The Secretary's contention is simple. That marriage was void ad initio. It is not voidable. It is absolutely void. And that is what you have with the candidate here. The qualification for office, meaning the residence in Director District 4, attaches at the time Ms. Spears became a candidate. And let me just answer a couple of questions that seem to be floating around. We're not talking about a presumption that she's disqualified. She has never disputed the fact of her disqualification. And she has, in fact, admitted her disqualification in the separate contest proceeding filed by Rico Figueroa in Broomfield County, where he served her with a summons and a complaint alleging that she was disqualified to hold the office, and she was required to answer within 10 days, and she did not do so. So that allegation has been deemed admitted.
Counsel, let me pick up on the earlier point about the notion that the election is void ab initio. And turning back to 2231.129, under 1F, it says, if a court of competent jurisdiction voids the officer's election for any cause whatsoever, it likewise triggers this vacancy provision. Why do we allow the secretary to cut off that process and instead not simply allow the election contest provision to go forward? And I'm stretching out my question here a little bit, but looking at the election contest provision, one of the bases for a contest is that the candidate elected is not eligible to hold the office mm-hmm. for which he elected. So to me, that contest provision seems to assume that an ineligible candidate can, in fact, become elected. That's the basis for the election contest. So help me understand how that fits in with your argument about duly elected.
Sure, because the fact that the qualification attaches, in order to be duly nominated, you have to be at the time of candidacy, and then you must meet all those qualifications in order to be duly elected, that carries all the way up through the date of the election.
Right.
And so what we have here in this case is the fact, the knowledge of all the players, all the parties, that Ms. Spears was not qualified. That fact and that knowledge happened before the election. The contest provisions, while still in existence and still adequate, they assume a whole host of variables that are hypothetical.
Such as?
What if you don't have a sophisticated candidate? What if you don't have a well-funded candidate?
Under the contest provisions, if you lose, you bear the other party's costs.
And so the secretary is allowed to step in lieu of the interested candidate who lost?
That's exactly right, Justice Martinez. Okay. And the reason for that is because the secretary is vested with rulemaking power, which has been recognized by this court time and time again to be used appropriately where it is intended to fill a gap.
But see, that's exactly my concern. I'm not sure I see a gap, because the election contest provision seems to very squarely permit a challenge to an ineligible candidate who has garnered the most votes. So if that's the basis for the disqualification, why don't you let the losing candidate just follow that provision?
What if the losing candidate can't? That undermines the entire election process for the school board.
It doesn't mean there's a gap.
It does if there's nothing on the front end prohibiting this rule. So council has made much to do about the fact that invalid votes are only deemed invalid when cast for dead or withdrawn candidates, or in the event we have a little bit of contention over whether it was an improper write-in candidate. But in this context, the secretary's point is simple. Nothing in the election code prevents a county clerk from not counting votes cast for an individual who is determined to be disqualified prior to the date of an election, notifies that candidate that he or she is not qualified, asks them to withdraw, and they refuse.
Your argument almost seems to be that if an election or a candidate more particularly isn't proceeding in good faith, and that somehow that in and of itself creates this gap that we've been talking about, as opposed to letting the good faith or bad faith of any candidate be determined later under the ordinary procedures. How is that statement incorrect?
I don't think it is incorrect.
And if it isn't incorrect, then why indeed do we not have a gap?
We do have a gap.
Well, where is it?
The gap is where the code does not address this particular issue, where you have a candidate whose disqualification is learned.
Well, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems to me that the thrust of my question was that there isn't a gap, because it wouldn't be appropriate to basically have the secretary intervene when it's his perception or her perception that there is an election going on where a candidate is operating in bad faith. And that almost seems to be what the issue is here. Everybody, quote, knows, okay, quotes around it. Mr. Raymond, I disagree, but everybody knows that this person isn't qualified. She's proceeding, staying on the ballot in bad faith. There's really no way to get to that issue. We're all upset about it. How do we get to it? And your solution is to have the secretary come in and promulgate a rule. Others maybe have suggested that the appropriate solution is to go ahead and let it play out, and then afterwards say, no, you're not qualified. So the question is there a gap? And I'm having trouble, perhaps like Justice Marquez is as well, finding that gap. So tell me, if you were writing our decision, what would you say? The gap is?
The gap is the comparison between 2131-129 and 1-4-1002 sub 2.5. If the legislature had wanted a vacancy committee process to appoint school directors in this context, it could have switched a few words in 1-4-1002 sub 2.5 and accomplished the exact same thing. They didn't do that. They did it for party nominations, party candidates, and partisan elections. But they did not do it for nonpartisan candidates. They fully, if you look at 1-4-1002, it's a comprehensive statutory scheme that addresses vacancies occurring prior to the day of an election. There's, 60 days before an election, 25 days before an election, 18 days before the election. You're in the window between 18 and the day of the election. Here's how you handle these specific situations. None of that exists for school directors. None of that exists for other nonpartisan candidates. It is a gap. The secretary has rulemaking authority under the 1-1-107 to promulgate such rules as he finds necessary for the proper administration and enforcement of the election laws. And then that rulemaking provision specifically says the provisions of this section, including his rulemaking authority, are enacted pursuant to Section 11 of Article 7 of the state constitution. to secure the purity of elections and to guard against abuses of the elective franchise. And that is exactly what his rule was intended to do, and it does do, and it is valid because it was enacted prior to the day or the close of the election, when the election officials responsible for counting the votes' hands could still be stayed. We do not dispute that there are ways to challenge Ms. Spears' election. And I use election in quotes because we do not believe she was duly elected. We believe she, her candidacy, her as plaintiffs might call her office, was void ab initio. But there are ways to challenge that if a set of variables are satisfied.
Thank you. Your time is up. Unless there are any other questions.
Gave reference to 1-4-1002 sub 2.5. And I was curious as to how the emergency rule, which is a rule of general applicability, plays out vis-a-vis that statutory provision, because that suggests, now I recognize this is about a vacancy in a partisan contest, but there's a whole series of circumstances that might give rise to that vacancy, including disqualification. And under that provision, it says in that case, when you're talking under sub A, where that vacancy arises in part because of the disqualification, votes cast for that candidate are actually to be counted and recorded. And I'm just curious how the rule 10.7.5 would play out under that scenario.
Sure.
That, as I understand the rule, it says if the DEO determines that the candidate is disqualified prior to the election, those votes shall not be counted. Like that statutory provision seems to conflict with.
Yes, and if the facts of this case included a partisan election with a party nomination and a disqualification occurring prior to the election, we would might have some serious problems.
But the rule is the one of general applicability, so that's my concern.
And it's also temporary, Justice Marquez. Okay. And during permanent rulemaking, the Secretary does intend to look at that very issue closely. But for purposes of this court's determination of the legal issues, the as-applied challenge, this rule applied to this candidate, Ms. Spears, in this context, a nonpartisan school district election. The Secretary contends that his rule is well within the bounds of the statute and the limits on his rulemaking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nothing else? Okay. Thank you very much. I want to thank both attorneys for your able presentations today. The court will be in recess.